session number 16726, Mr. H. Bell, Reel 3.
Mr. Bell, Reel 3.
I had my instructor's handbook, and I gave it to my son last week. Big fool scab book. It's all in there.
As part of the training at these early stages, obviously using Morse or whatever it was, you would need some kind of signalling, some code which would bring in your listener or whatever.
Oh, you had a code, yes, you had a code name. Able Charlie, calling Charlie Donner, you know, code letters mainly.
Did they tend to be the same, or did they change?
Oh, at that stage, nearly always the same. It was just the idea of using it. It wasn't a question. You knew very well that you could change it. You just used the common and garden ones. Able calling Baker, just any simple thing. It didn't really matter, did it? You know, because you were going to use whatever was given to you to use when you were actually doing the job.
Can we continue talking about the equipment that you had? This is the early equipment. What succeeded it in time?
Well, when we got on the radio, we had the 28 set, and that was succeeded by the 48 set, which was similar in appearance, but much more sophisticated. That stayed put with us right through the war, the 48 set.
How efficient were they?
Not very efficient. In the jungle, no, because especially when it was wet, the wet leaves and the wet trees absorbed the waves. Communication was very bad in the jungle. Useless, except in the open when it was dry. There were about 28-pound weight. There were quite a weight to carry around. We should curse it many a time. But certainly at Kohima, they were useless.
When these sets broke down or you had problems with them, how then did you communicate? Was there something to fall back on?
They didn't often break down. They were looked at before you went out and they stood and anything and they didn't often break down. We knew how to find faults. We had a system of finding faults. But I don't recall ever really putting them into full use.
You've said that in particularly damp conditions in the jungle, there was great difficulty with them.
They were just useless. The waves were absorbed by the wet.
What did you fall back on then when you couldn't use them in those circumstances?
You just didn't use them. You couldn't do anything. Mostly your radio was used on the move a lot of times. Anyway. We had the field telephone, and that was the main thing. That also got damaged. and you had to use runners, you know. Very little to fall back on. I'm talking about being in action on the hill like we were shut up at Kohima.
Field telephones, they'd be subject to the line breaking, were they not? Telephone lines.
Oh, yes.
Whose job then was it to repair those lines if that happened?
Us.
You were trained to do that?
We were trained to do that, yes.
How did you do it? What was the technique of moving to find your fault and
putting a pin through the cable? Pushing the cable through the cable, it keyed up, you know, with a tester, and you could find the break, where the break was.
And then you would go out and look.
That was the only way. That you had already gone out to look when you did that. You went and tested the cable at certain positions until you got out so far, all right there, gone there, and then you worked till they got the break. Did nothing break. The steel wire with a copper wire, you know.
Coming back to the section itself, you said there were 30 men and then a number of NCOs. Were they attached to headquarter company, the signalers?
Oh, yeah. Number one platoon in the headquarters, yeah. The platoon, you know, you were star performers.
And presumably then you were on call for any given company who would require...
Detachment duty, yes. You had no brother. Well, as a Lance Corporal, I went there with two men to a company, yes. Detachment duty, nearly all the time. Unless you were a headquarter waller. Mm-hmm.
At what point were you first promoted?
I was promoted to go on a signal training course at Catterick. You had to be an NCO to go on it. And
you were still in Ireland at this time?
No. I was with the 2nd Battalion by then. And my friend, Flackerhart, and I went on this course together, and we were made up at the time.
How long did the initial course, last in Ireland?
6 weeks. In Ireland. I came, well, it's difficult to say because whilst I was there, Dunkirk happened, and all leave was stopped, and I don't know what other holdups were involved in, and I didn't get back. I joined the 2nd Battalion at the very back end of August, because I remember I was at Bridlington when there was a suspected that the Germans were going to raid, and we stood to on the 7th of September, I think it was, we stood to all night.
This is 1940.
Mm-hmm. We stood to all night waiting for the Germans. I don't know what we're going to do when they got there, because we did. We only had one Bren gun in a battalion, I think, but we stood to all that. That was the 7th, and I had just joined the battalion then, so I'm assuming it would be about the last week in August in 1940 when I joined the 2nd Battalion at Bridlington.
And they'd been through a pretty bad time in France.
They were badly cut up, yes, in Belgium. They were badly cut up, and an awful lot of reinforcements, an awful lot of new people like myself in the battalion. I went to a company, first of all, as a company man, and I was trained light infantry, which wasn't easy in a farmer's field. It's not easy at all, but never mind. I was trained light infantry. Why I was ever trained heavy infantry, I don't know. I was with a company at Granger's Camp. It was a holiday camp with caravans and bungalows in a field, and that's where I was trained. B Company.
How long did that training last?
Not very long. I can't give you exact time, but apparently, the signal platoon was filled with signalers who weren't up to scratch, so I gather, because they were replaced by my mate and I and some others who had also been trained in Ireland. We replaced them, so I'm assuming that they didn't have the good training that we had.
Before we go on with the rest of your story, can we talk about...
I never did any company training with B Company.
Can we talk about the state of the battalion? Obviously, it'd gone through a bad time, and what was the morale like amongst those that had survived the Belgium campaign?
All right, I believe they had been at Huddersfield, the battalion, sort of reformed. I think it was Huddersfield, and They were a first class battalion. It was a regular battalion, and they were soldiers, and they reformed and you know, I got the impression when I came that they were a highly professional, good unit. So they hadn't suffered because of what they went through. They hadn't suffered at all. They had pulled themselves together and. But the equipment-wise, was ridiculous. When you had one old Ford van, one old Ford, navy blue Ford van, spade khaki, of course, and the one of the signalers, the Donars, he had a sports motorbike, which had a front wheel about 2 inches thick, and a great big heavy treaded rear wheel, and he used to go careering about the place, standing on his rear wheel. I think we only had about one remnant per company, I think. Equipment-wise, right at the bottom.
Who was commanding at Bridlington?
Ah. Shut up. Charlie V, who we knew him by, who was a tyrant. A tyrant and a first class colonel. His word was law. Two or three incidents. I remember one. I was on duty in the with the telephone at headquarters, and he came in to me. Corporal Billy says, "I want this unit manned by a signaler at all times, 24 hours a day. No more. A man on duty, 24 hours a day. Now get out of the room while I make a call." Another time, we were going off on a scheme. And I'm going to call him Charlie V because that was what we knew, man. And he was going out. He was going to go out on a Donars motorbike on the pillion. Percy Punches, no, Percy Peacock. Percy Peacock's motorbike. I was in the middle of the road, outside of headquarters, and Peacock. So Peacock came back with his motorbike, and Charlie got on and he sat on the pillion, and then he decided to tuck his coattails in, so he lifted himself off the pillion. And at that moment, Percy put the motorbike in gear and shot off and left Charlie Bay standing in the middle of the road, half squatting, with his hands on the cheeks of his backside, pulling the coattails in. And he says, "Peacock! Peacock! Back!" And he made Peacock reverse the motorbike, back till he could sit on it, sat on it, off Peacock. The DLI wore their forage hats square centre, dead centre, buttons vertical at the front, right between the eyes, and the divisional commander didn't like it apparently, and he said that we would fall in line and wear our hats on the side. As they were called side hats, they would be side hats. And Charlie B said, "Well, this is my battalion, and this is regimental custom. We wear our hats fore and aft, dead centre, and that's the way it stayed." Very strict disciplinarian, but he knew what he wanted, and he was very well liked by the men. He was a very good colonel.
Was he a good age, one of the elderly ones?
Yes. Couldn't see exactly what age he was. To me, at that age, he was an old man.
Were there any other officers in the battalion at this point in time who stand out in your memory?
My one signal officer, yes. Percy West, signal officer. Well, Percy, obviously, he had a sort of a hat, big bushy moustache, and he aped the gentry. But he was very nice, and he got on well with my mate Flacker Hart and I, as they were both Lance Corporals, and he told us to play chess, and when we went over to India, we played chess all the way over the boat together. So much so that all the platoons started playing chess, and when we got there, I think everybody played chess. But Percy West, he was very well liked. Nobody would try to put anything over on him, although he was a bit on the soft side. Nobody would. They liked him too much.
Was the signals officer supposed to have signals experience?
Oh, yes.
Appointment?
Yes, yes.
Well, he'd been through some form of training.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what, but he had, yes, yes. He was interested in us, and he was interested in a lot of other things. I remember in India, you know, the stars are beautiful in India. The whole sky is lit up, and he used to take us out and show us the various constellations and the stars. He was interested in this platoon, and this platoon liked him. Unfortunately, he went sick shortly after he got there, and we lost him.
So you joined the 2nd Battalion. Had you a stripe then?
No.
When did you get your stripe? First
to go on this course at Catterick.
Was this an extension course?
It was a six-week training course, signal instructor's training course.
What form did that take?
Everything. Radio, telephone, polyphone, flags, pigeons. Every aspect of we had to know it, and we had to be able to get up and give a lecture on whatever subject they wanted us to. That was part of the passing out, that they would give a lecture on this or that, you know, we had to.
You said pigeons, though. That's interesting. Did you ever use pigeons?
No.
You just had to have knowledge of them.
Knowledge of them, yes. No, we never used pigeons.
That was you would then come back to the battalion, as you say, with your first strike.
Yes.
What were the duties of a Lance Corporal? Or what additional duties did you have as a Lance Corporal?
Entirely different to a duty corporal, Lance Corporal. Knowledge. That's what you were there for. Knowledge. And you went out to detachment duty with two men, and that was it. It was you didn't need in the signal platoon. They were all intelligent people. You didn't need to show your rank. You know, you didn't need to. They knew we were instructors, and they appreciated, and that was it. We never had to use rank, never.
Being promoted out of your group, not out of, I mean, but in within your group, but beyond the private, you know, was that resented at all?
It wasn't resented. The only thing was that you weren't supposed to go out of the barracks, out of the area with anybody below who it didn't have. You weren't supposed to. Contrary to the it was for disciplinary purposes. If you went with them, under with them one night, you might have to book them the next day, and that was it. So an NCO was never supposed to go out with a duty man.
Lance Corporals are traditionally supposed to be the most put on rank in the army. Is that so?
Yes, you're neither one thing nor another. You know, yes, it wasn't a well looked upon rank. No. No, you weren't either one thing or another. It was very difficult to exert influence or, you know, you had to attend, but it wasn't very difficult because you weren't highly respected, shall we put it that way.
Did you get an increase in pay as a Lance Corporal?
Sixpence a day, I believe it was.
What were you doing at Bridlington? You're still in the platoon.
Coastal Defence.
And what was your job, your signalling job?
I spend a lot of time. We had a link up with a radio set, and I can't remember the name at the moment. Was it a 27 set or something? It was a fixed wave radio. It was rather like a radio telephone, and to the very companies which were on coastal defence, up and down the coast, and I spent a lot of my time on the front at Bridlington in a hotel, the Beaconscliff Hotel. I went back there a few years ago and I couldn't find it. The Beaconscliff Hotel it was, and it was in the big bay window, and we had this telephone, a lot of sandbags around. We had the telephone in the front window, and we weren't there because of any attack on the coast, you know, to get to the two headquarters. Very dull and boring it was. Very dull. But had to be done.
Did you speak to these companies over what, certain periods of time of the day, or was it only when you had something to say to them?
Just when we had something to report. Mm. Yeah.
Presumably, you would have to make sure that communication was there at the beginning of every
day or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
And then just when you had something to report that you spoke to them. The accommodation of the signal platoon at Bridlington?
It was in a farmyard just outside of Bridlington, but maybe 3 miles outside. Terrible. We were, the signal office was at the bottom part of a sort of a barn-like structure. And it was protected with sandbags, and the loft was sandbagged on the floor, and we slept on top of the sandbags. It was very, very cold and wet and uncomfortable, and the farmyard was like all farmyards are, especially in bad weather. It was anything but nice. Anything but nice.
Did you have any battalion company duties to do as a signaller outside of signalling, outside of your signalling work?
No, you signallers never do the headquarter guard. Yeah, occasionally, but you did telephone exchange duty instead. You see, that was your night duty. So you didn't really do any guards at all. Or patrol. On night patrol.
This was late in the year, so the weather wouldn't.
We weren't liked, you know. Because of this, we weren't very popular with the Sergeant Major.
Did that cause any problems?
No. Didn't cause any problems. Just you weren't very popular. It was all because he couldn't lay his hands on you, couldn't get you.
And the rest of the men in the companies, did they understand that you had a little bit easier task than they had?
There was not animosity, it's very hard to say. We were number one platoon. And we were the best. That was our opinion. There was a lot of rivalry. Not animosity, rivalry. It showed itself in various ways, which I'll probably come on to later on.
While you were at Bridlington, did you have any invasion scares or parachute scares, this kind of thing?
Yes. We had this big stand to on the 7th of September. That was the only big one we had, I think. Apparently, had been something happened at sea that day. I think it was connected up with an E-boat patrol or something down the south at that time. I believe so, but I'm not certain. But it was a scare, and nothing happened. Nothing happened.
And you would presumably be called out to your various companies and headquarters, of course, at for that time during the time of the scare.
Oh, it was only the one night, wasn't it? That was all. The rest of the time, we had the detachments out down the coast, and they used to ring in everyone reporting. I don't remember anything. There was a little bit of activity with the Akak platoon. There was a light, a German bomber came in, and struck very low, and I don't remember if they fired at it. Fired it at the time, but that was about all. The worst part, it didn't happen to us, but we could see Hull across the bay, getting hammered every night, bombed every night. It was, a terrible thing to see. They see the flames shooting up night after night after night. We got in the news once. They dropped a bomb on the post office in Midlingham, and Lord Ho-Ho came on and said, we have bombed your post office. We'll be back again.
Were there civilians about at this time?
There were some, yes. There was some. It was a good part of Midlingham, and there were all semi-detached houses. Yes, funny things happened there. On the way back to the from Bridlington up to the we were billeted in a house, a very modern house, and the chap who owned the house, it was the semi-detached, and there was a very low wall between the houses, a low wall running between the houses, and he had planked, and it was full of coal. Full of coal, big blocks of coal at the front, and full from back to front. We had baths all the time when we were there, hot baths. We carefully replaced the big blocks of coal at the front and used it all from behind. I don't know what on earth happened when he eventually got back to his house and looked for his coal, because all he would find was these blocks of coal at the front.
This would all be requisition property.
Yes. We spent a lot of time sandbagging. I don't know whether you know Bridlington or not, but it's the promenade is very high, the beach is very low, there's a lot of steps up, and we were sick of carrying bags full of wet sand up and down, and we had a signal office. We did a beautiful job of it, because that was ours, wasn't it? All the corners of the sandbags were tucked in. It was beautiful, immaculate. And an old lady living across the street, she said, come on, girl, she says, I can't help but admire that beautiful sandbagging. Do you think you could do mine for me? I don't know how much you want me to talk about this, but we had a sergeant major there who was noted for his bad language. And one of his favourite things was, I'll stand on your toe caps, climb up your kneecaps, crawl up your button, and I'll poke your bleeding eyes out. And the people wrote in and complained about his bad language. It was picturesque, about bad language.
What was his name?
Lackenby. George Lackenby.
The people received you well, did they?
There were hardly any people there. From what I heard, the moment the scare started, they all fled. There were very, very few people there. Very few.
Were the beaches mined and wired?
They were wired. I don't know about the mine, but they were wired, definitely. And there was a stretcher beach you could use. We used to, whenever possible, stand. Watch the WAFs doing PT at the beach. Well, you have to abuse yourself somewhere, haven't you? With the passion killers on.
And these would be from some nearby air station?
Yeah. I don't know where they were from. There was an airdrome at Driffield. Oh, Driffield. Can I tell you about Driffield? every Sunday morning. They were forming the RAF regiment. And every Sunday morning, quite distant away at Driffield from Ridlington, we went there and we attacked. They defended, we attacked, we took that aerodrome Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. They were learning, I suppose.